Hi, everybody. Today's Wednesday, April 30th, 2025. And our friend Pepe Escobar is back with us. Welcome back, Pepe.
Ciao, Nima. How are you? Good to be with you.
Pepe, aren't you?
Yes, exactly. Let's switch back to English.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why we're talking.
Before the beginning.
When we talk about the situation in the Middle East, we have to understand the new decision of the Trump administration in terms of fighting Yemen. When you look at the situation right now with the MQ-9 Reapers and then two F-18s, and the way that Donald Trump, it doesn't seem that they're trying to change their policy toward Yemen. Do you think that they're going to be there for just fighting for the sake of fighting and not knowing what would be the end of this fight?
Well, I would say there is not even a whiff of strategy in this whole operation. To start with, the absurdity of it all, when you see a president of the United States authorizing an absolutely illegal war, but this is the empire. The empire specializes in illegal wars, like unilateral, illegal, no consultation with anybody, against just because Yemen is fighting against the genocide in Gaza. So essentially, the rationale of this war is to protect a genocidal regime. In itself, this is already absurd. To compound the absurdity, we have this so-called most spectacular army in the history of all the galaxies combined being humiliated by the Yemeni armed forces practically on a daily basis. 22 MK9 Reapers, if I'm not mistaken, and counting, right? And the latest story, which is, it's a beauty. No screenplay in Hollywood would come up with something remotely similar. And if he did, everybody would say, but you're lying. This is completely absurd. No, it actually happens according to the CENTCOM Pentagon version. You have an aircraft carrier, which, as you all know, is a monster, practicing, I would say, a sort of Formula One maneuver in the middle of the Red Sea, like a sharp turn of 90 degrees or something like that, full speed, theoretically to protect itself from incoming Yemeni fire, ballistic missiles and drones. And in the middle of this maneuver, we have an F-18, probably in a sign of protest, of disgust, plunging into the Red Sea just like that. So this is the story that they are selling to all of us. The whole thing is, the mind boggles, right? So it's humiliation after humiliation. And obviously, and there's no sign of stopping. Because the man in charge of this operation, Secretary of Defense Hegseth, an Islamophobe, as all of you know very, very well, is absolutely uncontrolled. And Trump obviously gave Hegseth a green light to do whatever he wants vis-a-vis EM. So there's no strategic objective. There is no strategic mission. There's no way to achieve, even if there was a strategic objective, how to achieve it. They have not managed to exercise, between commas, in their own terminology, freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. The Yemeni armed forces, Ansar Allah, they still control the Bab al-Mandeb and the Red Sea. And they are being humiliated by the Yemenis nonstop. So what's the whole rationale about the whole thing? It doesn't exist. Obviously, the whole global South sees it for what it is, a self-inflicted humiliation by CENTCOM and the Pentagon. This is now being seen graphically from Latin America to Africa to all across Eurasia. And the most incredible thing is that the United States government is willing to pay this price and support this cloud, these clouds of humiliation, just to defend what Israel is doing in Palestine. It's unscriptable, something like this, but it's actually happening in front of us.
In your opinion, how it seems that many people in the United States are concerned about the talks between Iran and the United States.
They are.
Yeah. Yesterday, I talked with Colin Wilkerson. He said that he doesn't agree with Pete Hegseth, but he feels that the people who are behind some sort of movement to remove him from power, from Pentagon, they want a war with Iran. And they know that Pete Hegseth is somehow closer to Donald Trump in terms of going to war with Iran. How do you see the situation? On the other hand, we know that they're just advancing in terms of negotiations, technical teams are communicating. How do you see the situation between Iran and the United States? And we know that Netanyahu wants a war. He mentioned recently in a video, he said, we don't need Iran to enrich uranium. They can get it from other countries, but they cannot produce it in Iran.
Well, it starts with the absurdity of the war criminal leader of a genocidal government dictating terms to the White House and to the American system. Well, all of us know that this is what always happens now, but now it's an in-your-face process. He goes out in his megaphone and he dictates terms in front of a global audience. Hegseth is not the problem per se, or even the Pentagon. The Pentagon has all of us, we know that the Pentagon has gained every possible scenario in a war against Iran, and the U.S. loses in all of them. And this for, I would not even say years, decades, since the times that Rumsfeld was on that. Rumsfeld, McCain, and all these idiots, they were on a bomb, 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 bomb Iran dementia. Very, very well. I followed that very, very closely. And at the time, I went to Iran twice in the middle of the 2000s. I went in 2005 and 2006 when the bomb Iran dementia was at, you know, up there. The problem is all those silos in the Beltway, inside the CIA, inside the Pentagon as well, inside the industrial military complex, very well implanted the industrial military complex, and the think tanks, academia, media, everywhere. This hasn't changed. There are slight fluctuations for the past 40 years, but the mentality is still the same. Regime change in Iran, whatever it takes. And any excuse is a good one. The nuclear program has always been an excuse. And this was even during the negotiations in Vienna in 2015, this was obvious because the Americans, they were not essentially thinking about a solution for the nuclear program. They were talking about Iranian missiles all the time. And this Zarif told us at the time. And the Iranian delegation who was briefing us at the time in Vienna, they were telling us all the time, look, this thing is not advancing very fast because they want to introduce missiles. And now, once again, the same thing. This there are no leaks about it, but anybody can bet that in the middle of the negotiations with Araghchi, the Americans are insisting on missiles. And this does not come necessarily from, I would say, American sources. It's Zionist access sources implanted inside the industrial military complex in the U.S. And they run the show. And they run most of the show. We all know that. And that's an enormous danger. Now there's even, it's being floated around, but this is spin, Nima, very, very important, that Trump himself doesn't want a war against Iran. He wants a deal. We don't have any hard evidence supporting this, but we do have our hard evidence that the Zionist axis and Tel Aviv, they want a war. And they are forcing this war on a new American presidency. And that's why it's so dangerous. First of all, is 3, 4, 5 meetings in Oman and eventually another one in Europe, etc., enough for the Iranian leadership to restore, I would say, 1% degree of confidence in an American administration? It's not. The rational actors in Iran know that even if Donald Trump signs a JCPOA 2.0, he can tear it up after a few months. There's absolutely no guarantee that the U.S. would respect a new deal, even if it is a, let's say, a Trump-imposed deal. And it, if it is a Trump-imposed deal, Iran won't accept it. It's simple as that. So at least we can imagine at the moment, the leaks are not detailed about the negotiations in Oman. But maybe with coffee starting to get a little bit of the picture in terms of Iranian requirements, Iranian rights, which are enshrined in UN resolutions and were enshrined after the signature of the original JCPOA. And then Witkoff goes back to Washington and explains that to Trump, assuming that Trump will understand it. And that's another story, right? So the whole mechanism is so complex, and the important details that in this case they matter a lot, they can lay under the carpet somewhere. They will never be found again. It's a very, very dangerous negotiation. No question. Especially considering that the only way out for this genocidal regime in Tel Aviv is an expanded war. They're expanding the war in Palestine. They're expanding the war to the West Bank, and they want to gobble up the whole of the West Bank. They were not going to respect the ceasefire with Lebanon, which they are not, by the way. They are breaking the ceasefire with Lebanon all the time. There's not much they can do against the Houthis because of it's very far away, and they assume that the Americans will take care of it, and they are not. Syria, they continue to gobble up Syrian territory, occupy Syrian territory, and they'll keep advancing as much as they want. And now they are sure, because they have the former head shopper, now with the Hugo Boss suit, is their asset. And he's saying, we're not going to threaten Israel openly, you know. So the big, big price continues to be a war against Iran, which they assuming there would be the horrifying scenario that there will be an attack, they simply cannot understand that the Iranian response is going to be devastating. And Iran, just so far, they only gave a few hints of what it might be. And still, because these people are, once again, they are fanatics, Nima. We all know that. They are apocalyptic, genocidal, psychopathological, Old Testament fanatics. Obviously, you cannot have a reasonable, diplomatic, enlightened conversation with them. And obviously, and they are on a delirium of annexation and perpetual war and oiling their killing machine to keep spreading their perpetual war. So there's all these variables that are so, so dangerous, essentially. So, and we are relying on the, essentially now on the capability of Araghchi and his team to prove to the American interlocutors how rational they are, and basically asking, okay, let's have some good faith on your side. Do you really want a deal? Prove it to us that you want a deal. We haven't changed our positions since the original JCPOA. We're not going to abandon our nuclear program. Our nuclear, our civilian nuclear program is legitimate, recognized by everybody, by the European partners, by Russia and China. Everybody recognized. And we're not going to abandon our missile program because this is self-defense. This is defense of our nation. So let's go. You want a nuclear deal? Let's try to reestablish a nuclear deal like we did 10 years ago. But will Trump understand this message? That's the big question.
Lavrov yesterday said that we are willing to improve the relationship between Russia and the United States, but we are not going to sacrifice our partners for the sake of a better relationship with the United States.
This is a very message. Yes. And especially because it was in the framework of the BRICS foreign ministers meeting in Rio, which was, I would say, it was quite productive in a sense. You know, Lavrov was the superstar before, during, and after. But that's obvious. That's Lavrov. And what he said before the start of the meeting in Rio was excellent in every aspect, from the proxy war in Ukraine to what the BRICS are discussing to even talking about the famous BRICS currency. And he had to go once again straight to the point and said, look, once we establish all the mechanisms that we are studying and testing, alternative payments, settlements, etc., then we can restart a discussion about a possible BRICS currency in the future. So he set the priorities, right? So especially the Western media will at least make an effort to understand, right? Very, very important. And on the efforts, on the mediating efforts between, let's say, the US and Iran, Russia can be extremely, extremely crucial. If Trump is willing to listen to Russia, as he says he is, we don't know. This could be another narrative, and he can change his mind in 5 minutes. Obviously, Russia, because they were in Vienna 10 years ago, before they were part of the negotiation of the original JCPOA, they can explain to Trump, look, we have a strategic partnership with Iran. We signed a very close partnership. We are partners. We're not going to let them down. We understand what they're doing. And we're ready to explain to you if you need extra explanation, extra help, so you can clinch a new deal with them, assuming that you're going to respect the deal. The only ones who can do this are the Russians, much more than the Chinese, even though the Chinese were also in Vienna in 2015. But the Russians in 2015, they had I remember, Lavrov was a top interlocutor in Vienna. It was not only Kerry and Zarif. Kerry and Zarif were the main interlocutors. The most important one after them was Lavrov, was not those stupid Europeans. Definitely not. So, and Russia at the same time is also trying to mediate between India and Pakistan. And this is all interlinked because these are all SCO members. And we have two SCO members threatening war against each other because of that very, very dodgy thing that happened in Kashmir. So what happened these past few days? Russia called both ambassadors in Moscow, India, Pakistan, sat down with both of them separately and told them, look, get your act together, and we're willing to mediate. After all, this is something that could be done inside the SCO. Maybe it would be too bureaucratic. Right? The Russians took the initiative to do it them by themselves. And because they have excellent relations with both, they can do it. So the role of Russia as mediator in big, big conflicts, now it's open to her, and everybody knows that, and they can deliver. Because all actors respect Russia. Essential. Let's see if the Americans take up the offer of Russia help to finally find a solution vis-a-vis the Iranian nuclear program.
Yeah. Pepe, if you put yourself in the shoes of Donald Trump, you see...
We can't, it's impossible. He's the ruler of the world, and he wants to be Pope. We are just a bunch of bumps compared to him. No, never.
I don't know if you watched the video. He was asked, "What's your take on the next Pope?" He said, "I would be the best option to be the next Pope."
Yeah, can you imagine that? Today was he's going to turn the Sistine Chapel into the Michelangelo Trump Tower Resort and Casino. Spend a night with Michelangelo, you know, and have a Trump breakfast the next morning. So, you know, there are no limits to his megalomania, literally. And it gets worse by the day, literally. He actually said, "I rule the world," in this interview on the 100 Days, before he said that he wants to be Pope. So soon he wants to be, a mix of Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader. Rule over all the galaxies, you know. Meanwhile, the real ruler, Mr. C, is, you know, progressing. He visited the NDB in Shanghai yesterday. He talked to Dilma. He visited the young AI experts in Shanghai. He doesn't need these big proclamations, you know. He's going to where it really matters. Oh, this is so. I wanted to show you this email. This is Soviet, old school Soviet Union Chinese papier mache of how things were when the international proletariat was at hand. You still find them around Shanghai. I found beautiful ones. They are replicas, of course. They are. But based on the ones that were circulating still in the 50s. Because this, there's a lot of terminology from Maoist times that is resurfacing now in China. I found that absolutely fascinating. The day I arrived in Shanghai, the next day I was already listening to United Front, Paper Tiger. This is Mao starting in the 50s, especially in the 60s, you know. But now applied to the tariff war. Absolutely fascinating. And now a further stage is the artificial intelligence war. For instance, why Xi Jinping was visiting AI new talents yesterday in Shanghai? He went to a super high-tech pole slightly outside of Shanghai to visit, to see what they're doing, to talk to these very young technicians and all that. Because this is the new front where sooner rather than later, China is going to overtake the US. It's
the real battlefield, by the way.
Exactly, Nima. It's the theme of my column that came out yesterday. A lucky coincidence. The column was published the day that Xi was in Shanghai talking to AI experts. And the sources for my column are people from Huawei that I talked to 2 weeks ago. And they gave me more or less the breakdown of the new chips, what they are doing, what they plan to do, how they are basically conquering the Chinese market. And soon they will conquer the supply lines in AI all across the global south and all that. So this is the new frontier, and very, very important. It's part of Made in China 2025. And we are arriving at 2025 now. As many of you know, our audience, China already leads 7 of 10 high-tech fields, soon 8. And in the next year or so, 2 years ago, two weeks ago, I was. People were telling me in Shanghai, "No, it's going to take us 2 or 3 years to catch up with the Americans." For the past 2 days or so, they started to talk about 1 year. So this means that we'll catch up with the Americas in the next few months. And this is something that all those so-called IT experts in the US were saying, never. They are incapable of fabricating 7-nanometer chips, 5-nanometer chips, 3-nanometer chips. No, the Chinese are already at 5 and soon 3. And they're developing technologies, new technologies, including a guy who was the top engineer, the top technician at ASML in Holland. He's back in China. So, you know, they're the best technicians from Europe to Silicon Valley. They are all working in China, many of them working for Huawei, and they are all into this new drive towards AI supremacy. So this is reality, Nima. It's not somebody bragging that he wants to be Pope or be the ruler of the world. It's reality show and reality. There you go. Or you have a Pentagon or a CENTCOM that think, look, let's send a message to those barbarians in Yemen. We throw a few bombs and they're going to be cowering. Look what's happening. Once again, reality show and reality. And this empire is very, very, very lousy at dealing with reality, especially with the president that the only things that he understands is a succession of reality shows where he is the main star.
In my opinion, what's killing the United States is the old policies of the Cold War and those sort of mindset. They don't just let them go. The world has changed. You have to have new policies. It doesn't seem that would be the case for that establishment in the United States, even though you have Donald Trump in office, and it doesn't change anything. You look at Ukraine, you look at the Middle East, the same sort of mindset.
Yeah. It's impossible, Nima, because it's ingrained. And much has to do with the fact that for 75, almost 80 years, they were the undisputed number one. The unilateral moment, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, even after 9/11, they still thought that they were number one and this was going to be the new American century. They were only 25 years ago. They were convinced that this would be the new American century. So it's ingrained. And when you are in Washington, which is a very provincial place, and you talk to these people from different agencies, you go to a dinner in one of the good restaurants in Washington, everybody sitting on that table works for the government, for an agency, for the industrial military complex, etc. You know, so it's a bubble. So they only talk to themselves. They simply don't pay attention to foreigners. They don't listen to foreigners. And they think that foreigners, by definition, are inferior. How can they learn? How can they learn that the Cold War is over? It's still going on in their minds. It doesn't matter that if not against the communists, it's again an autocratic dictator, or it's against the communists in China, or it's against the mullahs in Iran, or whatever, all those stupid cliches that they use all the time. So it's their incapacity to get out of the bubble, to start looking at the world outside of their little window. And that explains why the Cold War still lives. And then when you have a first-class diplomat telling them, like Lavrov or like Wang Yi, they get mad. They don't even understand why a top-class diplomat is telling them, look, try to get rid of your Cold War mentality. It's going to be much better for you. It's impossible for them to understand.
You look at the situation in Ukraine today, and Russia, I don't know if you saw the interview that Lavrov did with Global News.
I did. By the way, excellent. It was a written responses, and you could see that the responses were carefully calibrated. No? Uh-huh.
The question is, what else Donald Trump need to understand the position of Russia? They're just out there. Everything is out there.
Everything is out there, explicitly, detailed, carefully argued, explained and re-explained, not only by Lavrov, by everybody in the foreign ministry, by Putin himself in all the fora last year and the fora this year as well. You hit an iron wall all the time.
Yeah.
So in practical terms, apparently, the former New York real estate developer Witkoff may be starting to understand a few things. Considering the whole system in Washington, this is huge already. But it's like this. It depends on one individual. Can you imagine if Kellogg was the guy in charge instead of Witkoff? We'll be on the brink of two wars. A renewed war against Russia and a new war against Iran.
Yeah. That's why I think that Witkoff is somehow can be helpful in the process of negotiation, and because he's different, he doesn't have those.
And at least he's willing to listen, Nima. He's willing to listen, apparently, considering all the leaks. Apparently, he's willing to listen, and he respects Putin a lot. That's very, very important. We don't know about his relationship with Araghchi. I would love to answer this question in Iran, assuming we can get an answer. How do they view the relationship between Witkoff and Araghchi? Because you need to create mutual trust in a negotiation at this high level. For instance, with all their faults, with all their problems, the relationship between Zarif and Kerry was quite decent. Was quite decent. And it helped because they it came a time when they noticed that they actually understand each other, and that created mutual respect. It was very, very helpful. So if something like this happens between Araghchi and Witkoff, that would be a plus. Yeah.
The problem is that they didn't talk directly to each other so far.
Well, yeah. Exactly. They're not even sitting at the same table.
Yeah. God. But Pepe, just to wrap up this session, we know that you're going to be in Iran soon.
I'm really looking forward.
What you're going to do in Iran? And I was going to be with you.
I wish you would be there, Nima, really. But a lot of people couldn't go. It's not your case, of course, but the Americans, I was in touch with some of them, Mearsheimer, the judge, Jeffrey Sachs, and obviously some have commitments, and some said, look, at the moment, it's for us, it's very dangerous to go to Iran. It's a very complicated time. It's true. But I have a list of stuff that I want to do, which listen. In Tehran, especially, I want to listen to diplomats and academics at the highest level. I have a lot of questions. We're going to go to the University of Tehran, so I want to listen to the students at the University of Tehran. They usually ask excellent questions. And I want to travel. I think to go to return to Qom and Isfahan would be okay. But I want to go to the port of Chabahar because I would like to do a story about the international north-south transportation corridor and also go to the Caspian. Caspian, I think, could be possible. Chabahar, after what happened in Bandar Abbas, was going to be complicated. So I hope in 2 weeks I can have a much better picture of the domestic situation in Iran and, of course, all those very complicated dossiers in the international arena that they are involved at the same time. And I want to know more about their position inside BRICS, inside the SCO. the strategic partnerships with both Russia and China. So it's a list of, it's a lot of tasks, you know, but if this trip is successful, it's going to be essential to understand how Iran is positioned practically at the crossroads of the big chessboard at the moment, and of course the possibilities ahead, and of course some important details. For instance, between us and between us and our audience, I'm not convinced that what happened in Bandar Abbas was an accident due to negligence. I'm not convinced at all. And I already seen that some members of the Majlis are thinking the same thing. So you cannot have an investigation that in less than 48 hours concludes, it was an accident due to negligence. Really? No. So, but this is going to be a very tricky issue to discuss, especially with us foreigners. No? But so I'll try to find some alternative sources and listen to their, how do they ponder the situation, and if they have any sort of partial evidence showing that this was not just an accident. Because the timing and an attack on a port like that is an attack on the International North-South Transportation Corridor. And if we look at the actors who don't want the corridor to be a success, we may be on our way, right? Same thing, what happened in Kashmir. Who profits from pitting India against Pakistan? Very easy question, right? And we know that they tried this before and they will continue to try it again. And in the overall picture, it's what I have described as the war against the BRICS. The war against the BRICS is on and it's picking up speed very, very fast. Don't forget, India, part of BRICS. China, part of BRICS. China is involved in what happened in Kashmir, indirectly. Iran, part of BRICS. So, I think we are just in the beginning and things can become even more volatile and incendiary, you know.
And yesterday I talked with...
Go ahead, Nima.
Yeah, yesterday I talked with Scott Rader and Colin Wilkerson, both of them suggested that Israel could be behind what has happened in Iran.
I agree with them. Even without evidence, I would suggest that this is a line for a serious investigation. No question. No preconditions, no previous conclusions. But yes, this should be investigated thoroughly. And that, especially the timing.
Yeah.
The timing and the connection with the transportation corridor. Which, from the point of view of the US and Israel, is a disaster. Because this corridor is the alternative to Suez. And it involves three BRICS. This means that everybody around, across Eurasia, will want to be part of it.
If they find something related to Israel during the investigation process, I would wonder if Donald Trump would consider that as somehow Israel acting against his policy with Iran. Do you think that would be the case for Donald Trump? Or he knows that how important, you mentioned Bandar Abbas and how important is that for the North-South corridor.
Yeah.
He wants to choose this policy of confrontation and these terrorist acts, or he wants to support some sort of dialogue as he's trying to do with Russia and Iran.
We don't know, Nima. We don't know because he's a fabricator of narratives, because of the megalomania, ruler of the world, Pope, etc. We don't know. It could be a fantasy. He could mean what he says, or maybe he could not mean what he says. He could be just playing around. In my latest column, I found an absolutely brilliant Chinese essay introducing Trump into the whole universe of Alice in Wonderland. And basically, the essay was arguing that Trump is all those characters in Alice in Wonderland. He's the Cheshire Cat, he's the Mad Hatter, he's the Queen of Hearts, he's the White Rabbit. And I loved it, especially because it comes from a Chinese intellectual. So that in itself is already brilliant. A Chinese intellectual that reads Lewis Carroll totally gets it and reinterprets Lewis Carroll in a postmodernist way. I absolutely love it. So Trump is, one minute he's Humpty Dumpty, and the next minute he's like the Queen of Hearts. Off with their heads! And this applies to everybody, eh? Because he's the ruler of the world. So he's like a fictional character posing as the ruler of the world, impersonating a lot of characters, and changing meaning and narrative all the time. For instance, Lewis Carroll, we can say that Lewis Carroll started postmodernism already with Alice in Wonderland when he says that the meaning of a world is that meaning because I say so. And that's Donald Trump. This is the portrait of Donald Trump. If he says I am the I will be the Pope, that's it, because I want to be. If I say that I'm the ruler of the world, it's because I am. So if we're talking in terms of rational diplomacy, geopolitical decisions, etc., how can we trust a character, a shape-shifting character like this, who wants to be all characters at the same time? And this is what I think our Chinese friend, he captured brilliantly. Yeah. So, and that's where we are. If we could trust what 5% of what Trump says, but we never know what we can trust because he's shape-shifting all the time. So we can come to a point where everything that he says is meaningless. And that's very, very worrying when you have the ruler of the world as a running discourse on meaninglessness. It's very, very dangerous. It's very, very dangerous. And I would say this is the apex of postmodernism. We have a political ruler that took postmodernism to the galaxies.
Yeah, by the way, it's going to be so much difficult for the leaders in Russia, China, and Iran to deal with because they don't know.
It's because they're rational, Nima. You know, the leadership in Iran, in Russia, in China, they are very, very rational. They are precise. They don't, you know, they don't open their mouths to say whatever comes to them. No, they measure their interventions. They never announce stuff that they will do or they won't be able to do. And they're dealing with this shape-shifting blob. It's very complicated.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Thank you so much, Pepe.
Thank you. Enormous pleasure.
Como sempre.
Obrigado a você. And next, our next conversation will be from Iran. This is going to be a killer. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. That would be amazing.
Yeah, that would be amazing. Thank you, Nima. And thanks all of you, our audience, everywhere.